Our final case for today is United States v. Downey. Mr. Mullins.
May it please the Court, my name is Brian Mullins. I represent Connie Downey on his appeal of two of the conditions of his supervised release. We are arguing that two of those conditions amount to greater deprivations of liberty than is necessary to achieve the purposes of sentencing and therefore violate Section 3583.
Maybe you should start with waiver before you get into the conditions, because the government argues that after the district court, not once but twice, asked counsel if there were any objections to supervised release, counsel twice says no. And obviously we know a waiver is an intentional relinquishment. It's not just an accidental, oops, I forgot to think about this. But why doesn't this satisfy the criteria for waiver?
Well, there's no evidence that there was a strategic reason to not object. And so that's another aspect of the analysis. Also, prior cases have held that simply
a strategic reason is just one of those things that helps us infer, you know, whether there is intent. It's kind of indirect evidence of intentional relinquishment. If no one in the right mind would have relinquished the point for a strategic reason, then you can assume that it was an accident. But when you have the lawyer, you know, we've tried to encourage judges to put these questions out in a very clear and focused way, and the lawyer doesn't raise anything, so it's a problem, isn't it?
Well, it hasn't been found to be a problem in other cases. In the James case, a similar statement was made to the district court's question, were there any objections? Defense counsel said no, and that was found not to be waiver.
But wasn't that an open-ended question? I thought the question here was focused on supervised release terms in particular.
It was focused on the conditions as a whole. It wasn't focused on any specific
it didn't go
condition.
Down, you know, 1, 2, 3. I understand that.
And
it doesn't need to, though, does it?
No, it doesn't need to, but I think that would be a further argument in favor of waiver if there were questions as to each condition, or if each condition were read aloud. I don't believe each condition was read aloud. It was just incorporated.
People frequently waive that, though. Do you think that's not waivable? A lot of defendants don't want to go through some lengthy reading of...
It's waivable.
Yeah.
It's waivable, but that wasn't what happened here, I don't believe. And it is, again, that would be further evidence that waiver had occurred, and that didn't occur here. The general rule is that waiver is disfavored and should be construed liberally in favor of the defendant. So I think this is probably fair to call a close call, but where the rule is that waiver rules are construed in favor of the defendant, there doesn't appear to be a strategic basis for not raising the objection, and the response was no by defense counsel. I think the tie goes to the defendant in that case. And
I think we'll defer
to the court.
I think we have your point on that. But isn't the reasonable location condition consistent with our decision in U.S. versus Henry, in which we explicitly indicated that limiting the location to one that was reasonable would address the potential for abuse?
Well, I think the...
Especially on a plain error standard, because at worst, I mean, we would have at least forfeiture even if we didn't have waiver. So there is a higher bar.
We do concede forfeiture, and our problem with the language is that it gives full discretion to the probation office.
But Mr. Downey in particular, as I understand it, you know, wasn't planning on working. Didn't he say he was going to sit in his room and watch TV? He's an older man. He's 70 years old now, and by the time he gets out of his 57-month or whatever it is prison term, maybe let's assume it's a little less because of good time, he's not going to have a workplace that could be disrupted by a probation officer visit. That just seems like the realm of fantasy to me.
The workplace issue is probably less likely, but the possibility that he will be required to travel to his probation office, we believe, is likely. And I think in his case in particular is relevant and imposes that that burden, that undue burden on him, because he will
What goes into it being a reasonable location? Surely how far it is from where he is, or its accessibility by public transportation, or doesn't that go into the reasonableness calculation?
It would go into the calculation. Now, here, Mr. Downey will likely live in Waukegan. The probation offices in the Northern District are in Chicago, Lyle, and Rockford, so the closest probation office would be 50 miles, at least 50 miles.
But they'd travel around.
Correct, and that's, we're not objecting to a condition where the probation office meets Mr. Downey. The objection is that giving the probation office complete discretion might allow the probation office to require him to travel to the probation office itself, which could be an undue burden for Mr. Downey. Now, if that would arise and he had a problem with it, certainly he could go back to the district court and ask the court to reconsider those conditions, but he might risk violating a condition of his supervised release and starting that whole process. So what we're asking the court to do is to remand to just clarify that condition and add the language that we have suggested.
The 104-208 issue, I'm going to talk to your opponent about that. So you're not asking for a full sentencing on remand. You're just asking for a focus on these two conditions of supervised release?
Well, we did ask for a full resentencing
in
the brief.
I'm finding out whether you're still asking for it.
I think you weren't. I think a partial remand would do the job.
Okay.
Help me with this. Under a natural reading of the drug testing conditions, isn't it clear that the maximum number of drug tests are 104? The mandatory condition provides a limit of 104 per year of supervised release. And nothing in that is qualified as to whether that testing is done in a drug treatment program or otherwise. How then would it be read as allowing 104 more tests than the tests allowed as part of the treatment program?
If that is the natural reading, we don't have an objection to that condition. We don't believe it's necessarily the natural reading. We agree with the court's interpretation, but I think another possible reading would be that it does allow up to 208 tests when the conditions are combined.
And about four a week all throughout the year.
Including weekends, taking weekends out of the equation. So,
It's four a week, whether it's out of 5 days or 7 days, it's four a week.
And so just that possibility, I don't think any of the parties are suggesting that is appropriate. It's just a question of how do we make sure that it's not at some later date interpreted that way. And so we're asking.
Are drug tests in the substance abuse program done at the order of the probation officer or at the discretion of the persons running the substance abuse program? I think it's changed since I was there.
It may be ultimately the probation office's discretion, but I'm not aware of the specifics in the Northern District.
Maybe your friends
will ask. You'd like to save just a bit for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vandenberg?
May it please the court, Cornelius Vandenberg on behalf of the United States. I'd like to begin with the condition involving defendant's meeting with his probation officer at a reasonable location. This court has already upheld that language in Armour, and as the court said, suggested this exact language in Henry, the reasonable location modifier. Therefore, the district court did not plainly err by imposing that condition. If there are no questions on that, I'd like to speak to the issue of the drug treatment condition.
So the drug treatment condition, apparently there's an ambiguity there. And I understood from your brief that it's the government's position that these two conditions taken together don't accumulate. They just repeat that 104 tests per year is the ceiling, so two per week, not four per week. Obviously, it wouldn't have to be that many, but it can't go beyond that many. So since there's at least some possibility a probation officer might read this the way that Mr. Mullins reads it, what do we do? Do we send this back to the district judge to fix it? Does an opinion from this court saying that the cap, as Judge Rovner just articulated it, is 104, no matter whether they're for treatment or for supervision or for monitoring or for whatever purpose, it just can't be more than 104. How do we approach that?
Well, Your Honor,
I'm taking it that you don't say it's 100, that it's 208. If I'm wrong about that, correct me.
No, that's correct, Your Honor. We do not contend that this equals 208. Each of the conditions impose a cap, and they impose the identical cap.
But it's not 200. It's not 104 for treatment and 104 for monitoring.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. One reiterates the other, that this is where the max. And in the event that a probation officer was even going, I don't think you'd have to wait till the 105th test. I think if it got to a point where a probation officer was even on the schedule of going over 104, the defendant would have recourse to return to the district court during the time of his supervised release and to state that this is unreasonable.
But why shouldn't it be fixed now, since we all agree that it's wrong? 57 months minus time for good time isn't a particularly long sentence, so inviting a whole new round of procedure seems wasteful.
I don't think that we necessarily agree that it is unclear. I think the appellant, as they stood up here, said that the plain interpretation, as the government contends, is that these are both meant to cap it. You are correct that there could be ambiguity where someone could read it that way. If the court were to find that, the court wouldn't necessarily have to remand it. That is something that this court could modify on its own, since it's not a substantial portion of the supervised release condition that would affect the sentencing package. So I believe the court would be able to take that recourse as opposed to remanding it for that reason.
Is there any drug testing done that would not involve urine testing, such as hair or blood? And if so, could the provisions be read so, in that case, to allow more than 104 tests, as long as only 104 are urine testing?
Well, I think, Your Honor, in that case, if there was, let's say, a blood or hair sample testing, then in that case, that would still be capped under the mandatory condition, which limits up to 104 periodic tests for use of a controlled substance. Doesn't specify urine testing, and therefore it would be capped out there.
Well, actually, the discretionary condition refers to urine testing.
Yeah, it does.
Whereas the mandatory condition refers generally to drug testing. So that, I mean, that's the, why I'm asking.
Your Honor is absolutely correct that there is different wording. And what I'm saying is that because the blood or hair sampling isn't even provided for in the discretionary condition, which is limited to urine testing, that it would only conceivably be tracked to the mandatory condition. And therefore, again, if you were on track for over 104 blood and hair samples, you would be going above the cap of the mandatory condition 6, which is inclusive of all types of testing.
No, but Judge Rovner is making a good point. You know, you could be having blood tests, which actually will reveal certain kinds of substance abuse issues that a urine test won't. Suppose you had 50 blood tests, and you'd had, 100 urine tests, that is to say, less than 104 urine tests. So the 100 urine tests come under 9, the 50 blood tests come under 6. Why is that not possible?
Because I don't believe that they come under individual portions.
All it says is a drug test. It doesn't say what kind.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think when the defendant sits down and submits to a drug test, there is no indication at that point that you're doing this because of mandatory condition 6 or because of discretionary condition 9. The drug test is considered a drug test, and again, since the two have caps that essentially reference each other, identical caps, I think it's just interpreted, again, and there is a presumption that probation officers will interpret these conditions in a reasonable manner. I believe that it's interpreted at that time as counting towards the 104 cap of mandatory condition 6.
Mr. Vandenberg, on the actual form, which I think is docket entry 34,
yes.
It looks like it's a revision as of August 2nd, 2016. Henry case from Judge Posner comes down February 17th of 2016. Do you know if the form was revised as a result of the Henry opinion, or one way or the other?
I don't know for a fact that it was revised with respect to that. I know Armour predated Henry, and that at that point it was found to be the court upheld Armour. And I know that subsequent to Henry in in another case, this court – oh, I'm sorry. That's why I'm going back. In the case of Carson, which was in 2016, this court acknowledged that Henry was, in fact, proposing that it was proposing a reasonable modifier to it. So whether or not the form was in reference to that, I know Carson was in reference to that and acknowledging that that's what Henry was seeking, or at least one solution to the problem identified in Henry.
Thank you.
If I could speak as to the issue of waiver, the government contends that both these conditions were reasonable. It also contends that the defendant waived any argument that they were unreasonable. Here the defendant actively abandoned objection, and we believe we can infer that that is consistent with the defendant's strategy in this case, to argue that the defendant needed treatment, not incarceration. That was a recurring theme throughout the entire sentencing of this defendant. And the fact that the conditions that we're talking about here, which relate to ensuring that the defendant was not on drugs, that
but
he was receiving.
They're expensive. The government tends to charge people for these tests, paying for 4 tests or even 2 tests a week. Is the government going to underwrite this? Because Mr. Downey is indigent.
Mr. Downey is indigent, and as a result, he would not be charged for these tests.
So the government picks up the tab for all of this.
Yes, that's correct. As the defendant acknowledges, this court has repeatedly found that abandoning objection to supervised release conditions at sentencing when given ample notice through the PSR, which in this case was several weeks ahead of the sentencing, that can constitute waiver. If there are no further questions, in conclusion, for all the reasons set forth today and in the brief, the government would respectfully ask that this court affirm the district court sentence.
Okay, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Mullins? We'll give him a full minute.
I think the government conceding that the conditions with respect to the number of drug tests that are ambiguous, I think that requires at least a partial remand, because these conditions do have the force of criminal penalties, given that somebody can be incarcerated for violating the conditions. So I think that concession that they are ambiguous does require a partial remand to clarify those conditions. And just returning to waiver, we cited these cases in our brief, but just to repeat, their similar objection or similar comments were made. The court asked, are there any objections? The response was just a general no to the guideline enhancement that was in Seals. And that was a case from 2016 where it was found not to be waived. Criminal history, that was from Gill, also a case from 2016. And then restitution, case from 2017. So where there is no intentional relinquishment, where it's, at least it's not clear from the record and there's no strategic basis, waiver should not be found.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks
thank
to both
you.
Counsel. We will take the case under advisement. 10, the court will be adjourned.